Welcome to The Brainstorm, a podcast and video series from ARK Invest. Tune in every week as we react to the latest in innovation and reflect on how short-term news impacts our long-term views. To learn more, visit ARK-invest.com.
ARK Investment Management, LLC, is an SEC-registered investment advisor. ARK and Public are unaffiliated entities and do not have a relationship with respect to either firm marketing or selling the products or services of the other. And therefore, ARK disclaims responsibility for any loss that may be incurred by Public's clients or customers. The information provided in this show is for informational purposes only and should not be used as the basis for any investment decision and is subject to change without notice. It does not constitute either explicitly or implicitly any provision of services or products by ARK. An investor should determine for themselves whether a particular investment management service is suitable for their investment needs. All statements made regarding companies or securities are strictly beliefs and points of view held by ARK and/or show guests and are not endorsements by ARK of any company or security or recommendations by ARK to buy, sell, or hold any security. Historical results are not indications of future results. Certain of the statements contained in the show may be statements of future expectations and other forward-looking statements that are based on ARK's current views and assumptions and involve known and unknown risks and uncertainties that could cause actual results, performance, or events to differ materially from those expressed or implied in such statements. ARK assumes no obligation to update any forward-looking information. ARK and its clients, as well as its related persons, may, but do not necessarily, have financial interests in securities or issuers that are discussed. Certain information was obtained from sources that ARK believes to be reliable. However, ARK does not guarantee the accuracy or completeness of any information obtained from any third party.
Welcome to episode 42 of The Brainstorm. Today, we're talking nuclear cost declines or lack thereof and the changing landscape in the EV environment, whether that's a shift to hybrids or battery cost declines and what's going on there. Today, we've got Daniel McGuire, who's done all the modeling on the nuclear side for us. So, Daniel, what is happening with nuclear and why should people read the blog you just put out?
Sure. Thanks, Sam. And thanks, guys, for having me on. So I guess when it comes to nuclear, this week we put out a blog. As Sam has coined it, regulation can potentially kill innovation. So to kind of touch on high level takeaways, we estimate that the U.S. has overspent roughly $345 billion in the development of U.S. plants and ultimately rendering it less cost competitive than natural gas. So I guess before I explain how we got there, maybe to touch why are we looking at nuclear energy? So the International Energy Agency has kind of stated it's going to be pretty pivotal to reaching net zero by 2050. Given the recent flurry of AI advancements in recent years, there's an increasing taxing on energy for data centers and especially Bitcoin mining, which is leading to companies such as Microsoft looking at nuclear, as well as Sam Altman setting up a nuclear company called Oklo. There's increased regulatory support, which I can touch on too, which is a shift in what has been historically a pretty stringent industry. So maybe if we put up a chart on the screen and I can explain it to users who are listening to the best of my ability. But essentially how we arrived at this conclusion is that we plotted nuclear energy on a scatter plot. So on the x-axis, it's cumulative power deployed. And on the y-axis, it's overnight construction costs. So think of overnight construction costs as the capital cost of building a nuclear plant if it occurred overnight. So avoiding any kind of interest or finance costs accruing. So we plotted both the US and Japan on this chart, all of the plants that are being brought online. And the data kind of is showing a nice trend downwards, but then hits an inflection point in both countries at a given point. So to touch on the US, this point appears to be 1974, which coincides with the US Energy Reorganization Act. So what this act was is prior to this act being introduced, nuclear energy was governed by the Atomic Energy Commission, which had a somewhat conflict of interest. Not only did it govern regulation, it also supported research in kind of like a Department of Energy function. So what this regulation did was it separated the functions into what's known today as the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and also eventually became the Department of Energy. So with this separation came increased regulatory scrutiny, and coupling it with the nuclear disasters of Fukushima 2011, Three Mile Isle 1979, Chernobyl 1986, essentially kind of multiple factors led to this inflection point. So what we did was, is prior to this inflection point, we looked at the cost trend, and we estimate that in accordance with Wright's Law, which as a reminder is for every cumulative doubling in a unit of measurement, costs decline by a constant percentage. So we thought this was a 20% decline rate for overnight construction costs. So what we did was we extrapolated this cost trend and applied it going forward. So let's assume that this inflection point hadn't happened. And in doing so, if you compare the discrepancy of what was actually spent on plants versus what could have been spent based on the trend continuing on forward, this comes to this overestimate or overrun cost figure of $345 billion. And another key takeaway from that is that had these trends continued on a levelized cost of energy basis, which is the kind of total cost of a plant over its lifetime over the energy it produced, could be cheaper than natural gas today, which is a pretty interesting conclusion.
Daniel, what within the cost structure went up the most?
Sure.
As in, what did the regulatory, you know, policy do to specific costs?
Yeah, so there are kind of a few elements at play here. So one area which is kind of interesting is radiation protection standards. So I believe this is kind of still somewhat of a debate at the moment, but there is a huge increase in margin of safety required for regulation or radiation protection. And what's interesting is particularly at areas where it's a small radiation protection, there's no kind of clear scientific evidence at the time. And I believe it's still a debate on how impactful this can be. So perhaps in areas like this, they were over conservative. They also focused on like human elements. They increased the training requirements of operators, and just kind of a multiple of factors led to it. And even, for example, on the radiation, go ahead, Sam.
Oh, I was going to say, isn't one of the biggest factors just time?
Yes.
It's like it became incredibly difficult to complete projects.
Yes.
And so you have like crazy blowouts of timelines, which is the biggest, one of the biggest impacts on cost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because in order to comply with these standards, it was kind of taking a long time and then, kind of pushes the cost upwards.
So the regulation didn't increase any of the material costs going into the, you know, development. It was more so time. And then if I'm understanding, you know, you need potentially more material that maybe isn't totally necessary to build out these plants in different capacities, which is pretty interesting. So just more hoops to jump through.
Exactly. Yeah. And even like on the radiation front, I think a big misconception is like looking at Fukushima. I don't think anyone died directly from that, from direct radiation. There are kind of a couple of indirect methods, but that's kind of a common misconception when it comes to radiation.
Mm-hmm. And it's like nuclear is safe if done properly.
Yeah.
Right. Nuclear subs in the U.S. use far more enriched uranium than plants. I don't think we've ever had a accident on a nuclear submarine regarding the reactor. It's also interesting to think, one, this was like an own goal from environment activists on causing far more emissions from switching investment to natural gas than otherwise could have been to nuclear if we just kept following along that cost decline. And I think another interesting thing, this was in the SpaceX talk that Elon gave this past week, right? Nuclear in space could be an interesting application, good way to have a long duration energy production for a lunar base, a Mars base, something like that. So that could be pretty interesting as well.
Yeah. I think too, the tech aspect of it is interesting. There's also like Sam mentioned, enrichment is a key element of nuclear, which is bringing the more fissionable element of uranium up. And a lot of these new modular plants that are being used require a certain type of fuel with higher enrichment levels. And traditionally, this was done by gas centrifuges, but now they're looking at kind of ways of doing this with laser. There's also then, in supporting the construction, there's a potential element of convergence. I know some cores that have been built have used 3D printing, and there's also the potential of use of electron beam welding, which I believe can kind of speed up the development time of plants.
Are there any case studies of countries doing this the right way? As in, they didn't put in the necessary regulatory, or they didn't put in regulation, and you actually can see the cost decline? Or is this a global regulation that, you know, most countries implemented after the different blow-ups and such?
That's a really good question. And I think when people mention kind of nuclear, France comes to mind a lot. So I think today, roughly 70% of energy is sourced from nuclear in France. And coincidentally, in the same year, I believe, or within a margin of a couple of years, France implemented the Mesmer plan, it was called. And that was where they kind of dedicated that they wanted the majority or most of their energy to be sourced from nuclear. Whereas if you go across the pond, you have the US introducing more stringent regulation. And in terms of a cost basis or cost trend perspective, France didn't experience as much of an inflection point. I think it was trending at a similar rate of slightly below 20%, I believe. But you do also have to consider the anti-nuclear sentiment, which is just of as equal importance as the regulatory element, particularly post-Chernobyl. It increased a marginal inflection, not as severe as Japan and US, but I think it's difficult to pinpoint. Like, no country operates in isolation. So when you see these other countries imposing pretty strict regulations and different disasters, it's difficult to follow that trend over time.
Mm-hmm. And so maybe in the show notes, we'll see if we can do it, but we'll put Daniel's blog, and then you can look at the sources Daniel used as well, because there's tons of data out there, super interesting. And while we have Daniel on as well, and we'll get Nick's take here, because I think he's got a different side. We're going to transition to Tesla, electric vehicles, all of this. Everyone's talking about the newest update. You guys both drive Teslas. What's been your experience with the recent update?
Sure. Maybe I can go first, Nick, and then
you go. I think you have a more recent data point than me.
So my car is operating version 12.3.3, which I believe is the most up-to-date software. I was extremely impressed by this. It's very good on non-highways, so tough intersections, lights on, lights off, pedestrians crossing, right or left. I even saw on Twitter, I believe it interprets hand signals from pedestrians, which is...
No, Daniel, only your experience. Everyone can look at Twitter. What's your experience?
My experience is it's extremely good. I've probably driven maybe close to 20 hours using it. A couple of disengagements on highway. My off-highway disengagements have been a bit uncomfortably close to the curb. I probably didn't need to disengage, but I didn't want to rack up a bill of having to get my tires fixed or prevent any damage to them.
Hubcaps.
Yeah. Key takeaway, I suppose, is it's pretty impressive. I certainly don't think it's perfect yet. A couple of areas of improvement, but definitely noticeably different than previous versions. Nick, I'd be curious to know your...
Why
do you hate it?
I've only used it once, and I was actually in the car with you, Daniel. Yeah. I think it was, you know, in that short period, it felt like it was handling turns in the city of St. Pete better than it had before. Mm-hmm. But my experience having used FSD over many different versions is, you know, there's still corner cases that make me as a driver feel a bit uncomfortable. And, you know, when I'm driving, it's in most cases just easier for me to do it myself than have to be hyper aware of, you know, when is this going to freak out on me. I do love it for highway use. I think it's great on the highway. You know, just driving in a straight line, it's very good at. It's more so, you know, I'm not going to turn it on to go down the street for groceries. It's just not worth the time and energy you have to put in, even though that's counterintuitive to its purpose, right? It's supposed to feel, and it might just be I think maybe personal to me. Mm-hmm. I just feel a bit more comfortable having the control. You know, if I'm going to wreck the car, I'd rather it be on
I
would rather it be on I'd rather it be on me than the car, because then I would hold a grudge against it.
I was just going to say
Daniel.
I was going to say one last point too on it is that I felt like in certain instances, if like I'm somewhat under time pressure, I would personally drive, because under the speed limits, of course. But it just, I don't know, I feel like sometimes it waits a bit long on stop signs too, more than necessary.
Got it. All right, but this is just the segue. The real thing I want to talk about, there's a few things happening that I think are changing the landscape, I'd say, for electric vehicles. And I think we're entering this new era where it's like, you know, the last 10 years, 12 years, time flies, has been defined by battery cost declines, because this was a key enabling factor, right? The battery is the single largest cost component of the car. So if you go back and you see battery prices in 2012, if you wanted a 300-mile range EV, it was cost prohibitive, right? So it's like in the US, there's no greater than 300-mile range EV. And then in 2016, I think you got the Model S and it was like over 100,000. Then Model 3 and Y come out, and now 300-mile range EV is 50,000. You look at battery costs today, right? They're roughly $60 per kilowatt hour for lithium iron phosphate. You have people making extremely inexpensive vehicles in China. I think it's possible. Obviously, it's extremely difficult to do, but I think we're at the point with battery cost declines where it's no longer the, you know, the limiting factor here, the gatekeeper. We should have affordable, acceptable range EVs in the next couple of years. And so I think that's going to change the dynamics ahead. At the same time, you know, what do you have? You've had huge investment in battery capacity. And now you have traditional automakers who are kind of pumping the brakes, saying that they're going to focus on hybrid, delay some EV projects. And so you have the chance where you could have battery cost declines come down even faster than would otherwise be the case, at least for a short period of time, because of an oversupply. And so it's like, I really think these companies that are going to focus on hybrid are going to actually make it better for the pure play companies who are willing to push through on their investment for pure battery electric. And I feel like it's kind of, you can't blame Ford, because they're looking at the next year or two, and they're going to, I mean, they're just following their customers essentially and what they can offer them. And it's like, they can't offer them a high quality, low cost, long range EV. I think that's become pretty clear. And so they're going to go hybrid, and I think hybrid's going to eat their gas powered vehicle sales. But more than that, you're going to have the pure play battery electric vehicles eating both hybrid and gas. So I think this is a short term move, innovators dilemma esque type problem, and a mistake to focus on the short term.
As in hybrid.
Yeah.
Yeah. Gotcha.
So
what was the, I think someone gave an analogy on Brainstorm and Friday about hybrid. Do you remember it? I don't know. I don't want to butcher it.
I mean, I'll say a couple things. You tell me which one do you think it was?
Yeah,
it's the worst of both worlds, right? You're taking a complicated system, you're adding another complicated system, and now you've got an even more complex system. So that's bad, just generally speaking, and leads to higher maintenance costs. The analogy that I made is, I feel like this is reminiscent of COVID, and you had the traditional automakers cancel their semiconductor orders, which is, you know, apparently something that you never do. And then those factories shut down and reallocated to other providers. And then for the next 2 years on earnings calls, you heard them say, you know, we don't have the supply of semiconductors. And it was because they made a knee-jerk, short-term oriented decision. And I think this is you know, a replay of that.
I think the analogy was it hybrid reminds, I forget who said this, so apologies on not giving proper credit here, but it would be, you know, the comparable to when the original combustion engine was created, using that in conjunction with horses. And, you know, tying a horse to like an original combustion engine car and seeing if it, you know, helps performance in some way. Obviously, it's not the proper solution over the long term.
All right. I think that's it. We can keep it nice and short. You know, Tesla did announce that they're going to unveil a robotaxi on August 8th.
I have a question there.
That's okay, but that's going to be a conversation,
right? No,
we're going to discuss that this week, and then we'll probably talk about it next week.
Is this the 2-seater rumored car, or is this a before we discuss it? What are your predictions?
Pre-discussion?
Yeah, well, Yeah,
it sounds like it's right. This is the platform on which a compact car or a robotaxi could be built. Mm-hmm. So it sounds like there will be versatility. We also know that they're working on their unquote unboxed manufacturing process, which could be a part of this as well. And sounds like it likely will be. And I think we can leave it there and dive in next week.
Definitely. All right. Thank you, everyone.
See ya.